Chapter 48. Good Sir. King William Land, latitude, unknown. Longitude, unknown. 18 July, 1848. From the private diary of Dr. Harry D. S. Good Sir.
Tuesday, 18 July, 1848. 9 days ago, when our captain sent Lieutenant Little and 8 men ahead in the whaleboat through the lead in the ice with orders to return in 4 hours, the rest of us slept the best we could for a pitiful remnant of those 4 hours. We spent more than 2 hours loading the sledges onto the boats, and then, taking no time to unpack tents, we attempted to sleep in our reindeer skin and blanket bags atop waterproof tarps set down on the ice next to the boats themselves. The days of the midnight sun were past now in early July, and we slept, or tried to sleep, through the few hours of near darkness. We were very tired. After the apportioned 4 hours were up, First Mate DeVoe woke the men. There was no sign of Lieutenant Little. The captain allowed most to return to sleep. 2 hours later, all were wakened, and I tried to lend a hand as best I could, following the orders of Second Mate Couch as the boats were made ready to launch. As a surgeon, of course, I always have some fear of injuring my hands, although it is true that so far on this voyage they have suffered every insult short of serious frostbite and self-amputation. So it was that 7 hours after Lieutenant Little, James Reed, Harry Pegler, and the 6 seamen had set off on their reconnaissance, 80 of us on the ice prepared our own boats to follow. Due to movement of the ice and lowering temperatures, the lead had narrowed somewhat during the few hours of darkness and few more hours of sleep, and getting the 9 boats placed properly and launched correctly took some skill. Eventually, all of the boats, the 3 whaleboats with Captain Crozier's in the lead, Second Mate Couches in second position with me aboard it, and then the 4 cutters, commanded respectively by Second Mate Robert Thomas, Boatswain John Lane, Boatswain's Mate Thomas Johnson, and Second Lieutenant George Hodgson, followed by the 2 pinnaces under the command of Boatswain's Mate Samuel Brown and First Mate Charles DeVoe. DeVoe was 3rd in command of our overall expedition now, behind Captain Crozier and Lieutenant Little, and thus assigned the responsibility of bringing up the rear. The weather had grown colder, and there was some light snow falling, but by and large the fog had lifted to become a low-hanging layer of clouds, moving only 100 feet or so above the ice. While this allowed us to see much farther than in the fog of the previous day, the effect was oppressive, as if all our movements were taking place in some strange ballroom set in a deserted Arctic mansion with a shattered white marble floor underfoot and a low grey ceiling with trompe-l'oeil clouds just above us. At the moment the 9th and final boat was shoved into the water and its crew clambered in, there was a faint and sad attempt at a hurrah from the men, since it was the first time that most of these deep-water sailors had been afloat in almost 2 years, but the cheer died a mourning. Concern about Lieutenant Little's crew's fate was too great to allow for any sincere hurrahing. For the first hour and a half, the only sounds were the groaning of the working ice around us and the occasional answering groans of the men working at the oars. But seated near the front of the second boat as I was, sitting on the thwart behind where Mr. Couch stood at the bow, knowing that I was superfluous to all locomotive purposes, as much dead weight as the poor comatose but still breathing David Lays, whom the men had been hauling in one of the pinnaces without complaint now for more than 3 months, and whom my new aide, former steward John Bridgens, duly fed and cleansed of his own filth every evening in the medical tent we shared, as if he was caring for a beloved but paralysed grandfather, ironic, since Bridgens was in his early 60s and comatose Lays was only 40, my position thus situated allowed me to hear whispered conversation between the men at the oars. "Little and the others must have got themselves lost," whispered a seaman named Coombs.
"There ain't no way that Lieutenant Edward Little got himself lost," shot back Charles Best. "He may be stuck, but not lost."
"Stuck in what?" whispered Robert Ferrier at an adjoining oar.
"This lead's open now. It was open yesterday. Maybe Lieutenant Little and Mr. Reed found the way open ahead of them, all the way to Back's River, and just raised their sail and went on,"
whispered Tom McConvey from one row back.
"They're there already, is my guess, eating salmon that jumped into their boat and trading beads for blubber with the natives."
No one said anything to this unlikely suggestion.
The mention of the Eskimo had caused quiet consternation since the massacre of Lieutenant Irving and 8 of the savages on 24 April last. I believe that most of the men, however desperate for salvation or rescue from any source, feared rather than hoped for another contact with the local native people. Revenge, some natural philosophers suggest, and sailors endorse, is one of the most universal of human motivations. 2.5 hours after leaving our campsite of the previous night, Captain Crozier's whaleboat broke out of the narrow lead into an open stretch of water. Men in the lead boat and my own boat let out happy shouts. As if left behind to point the way, a tall black ship's pike stood upright, embedded in the snow and ice at the exit from this lead. The night's snow and freezing drizzle had painted the northwest side of the pike white. These shouts also died a borning as our close line of boats pulled out into open water. The water was red here. On shelves of ice to the left and the right of the lead opening, crimson streaks of what could only be blood were smeared on the flat ice and down the vertical planes of the ice edges. The sight sent a shiver through me, and I could see other men reacting with open mouths. "Easy now, men," muttered Mr. Couch from the bow of our boat. "This is just the sign of seals caught by the white bears. We've seen such seal gore before in the summers." Captain Crozier in the lead boat was saying similar things to his seamen. A minute later, we knew that these crimson signs of carnage were not the residue of seals butchered by white bears. "Oh, Christ," exclaimed Coombs at his oar. All the men quit rowing. The 3 whaleboats, 4 cutters, and 2 pinnaces floated into a sort of circle in the choppy, red-tinted water. The bow of Lieutenant Little's whaleboat rose vertically from the sea. Its name, one of the 5 boat names not changed after Captain Crozier's Leviathan sermon in May, the Lady J. Franklin, was clearly visible in black paint. The boat had been broken apart about 4 feet back from the bow, so that only this forward section, the ragged end of shattered thwarts and splintered hull just visible beneath the surface of the dark and icy water, floated there. The men began gathering other flotsam as our 9 remaining boats fanned out and rowed slowly forward in a line. An oar, more bits of shattered wood from gunwales and stern, a steering sweep, a Welsh wig, a bag that once held cartridges, a mitten, a bit of waistcoat. When Seaman Ferrier used a boat hook to pull in what looked to be a floating bit of blue peacoat, he suddenly cried out in horror and almost dropped the long gaff. A man's body floated there, his headless corpse still garbed in sodden blue wool, his arms and legs hanging down in the black water. The neck was a mere bit of severed stump. His fingers, perhaps swollen by death and the cold water, but looking strangely shortened into broad stubs, seemed to move in the currents, rising and falling on the slight swell like white worms wriggling. It was almost as if, voiceless, the body was trying to tell us something via sign language. I helped Ferrier and McConvey pull the remains aboard. Fish or some aquatic predator had been nibbling at the hands. The fingers were gone to the second joint, but the extreme cold had delayed the bloating and decomposition processes. Captain Crozier brought his whaleboat around until its bow was touching our side. "Who is it?" muttered a seaman.
"It's Harry Pegler," cried another. "I recognize the pea jacket."
"Harry Pegler didn't wear no green waistcoat," interjected another.
"Sammy Crisp did," exclaimed a fourth seaman.
"Silence!" bellowed Captain Crozier. "Dr. Goodsir, be so good as to turn out our unfortunate shipmate's pockets."
I did so. From the large pocket of the wet waistcoat, I pulled an almost empty tobacco pouch, tooled in red leather.
"Ah, shite," said Thomas Tadman, sitting next to Robert Ferrier on my boat. "It's poor Mr. Reed."
And so it was. All the men then remembered that the ice master had been wearing only his peacoat and green waistcoat the previous evening, and all of us had seen him refill his pipe 1,000 times from that faded red leather pouch. We looked to Captain Crozier as if he could explain what had happened to our shipmates, although in our souls we all knew.
Secure Mr. Reed's body under that boat cover, ordered the captain. We'll search the area to see if there are any survivors. Do not row or drift out of sight or shouting range.
Once again, the boats fanned out. Mr. Couch brought our boat back to the ice near the inlet opening, and we rowed slowly along the icy shelf that rose about 4 feet above the open water's edge. We stopped at each smear of blood on the surface of the floe and on the vertical face, but there were no more bodies.
Oh, damn, moaned 30-year-old Francis Pocock from his place at the sweep in the stern of our boat. You can see the bloody grooves of the man's fingers and nails in the snow. The thing must have dragged him backwards into the water.
Batten down your garb on such talk, bawled Mr. Couch, holding his long pike easily in one hand, like a true whaleboat's harpoon.
He had one booted foot up on the whaleboat's bow as he glowered back at the rowers. The men fell silent. There were three such bloody spots on the ice at this northwest end of the open water. The third one showed where someone had been eaten, some 10 feet back from the edge of the ice. A few leg bones remained, as did some gnawed ribs, a torn integument that might be human skin, and some strips of torn cloth, but no skull or identifiable features.
Put me on the ice, Mr. Couch, I said, and I shall examine the remains.
I did so. Had this been ashore almost anywhere in the world but here, flies would have been buzzing around the red meat and muscle left behind, not to mention the strands of entrails, looking like a gopher's burrowing ridge beneath the thin covering of last night's snow. But here there was only the silence and the soft wind from the northwest and the groaning of the ice. I called back to the boat. The seamen were averting their faces and confirmed that no identification was possible. Even the few remnants of torn clothing could give no clue. There was no head, no boots, no hands, no legs, not even a torso, other than the heavily gnawed ribs, a sinewed bit of spine, and half a pelvis.
Stay as you are, Mr. Good Sir, called Couch. I'm sending Mark and Tadman to you with an emptied shot bag in which to put the poor bugger's remains. Captain Crozier will be wanting to give them a burial.
It was grim work, but done quickly. In the end, I directed the two grimacing seamen to pack away only the rib cage and bit of pelvis into the shot bag burial shroud. The vertebrae had frozen into the floe ice, and the other remnants were too grisly to bother about. We had just shoved off from the ice and were exploring around the south rim of the open water when there came a shout from the north.
Man found!
Some seamen cried.
And again, man found!
I believe that we all could feel our hearts pounding as Coombs, McConvey, Ferrier and Tadman, and Mark and Johns pulled hard, and Francis Pocock steered us to a cricket pitch-sized patch of floating ice that had drifted to the centre of these several hundred acres of open water amid the frozen floes. We all wanted, we all needed to find someone alive from Lieutenant Little's boat. It was not to be. Captain Crozier was already on the ice and called me forward to the body lying there. I confess that I felt slightly put upon, as if even the captain was unable to certify death unless I was forced to inspect yet another undeniably dead corpse. I was very tired. It was Harry Pegler lying there almost naked, his few remaining clothes mere underthings, curled up on the ice, knees raised almost to his chin, legs crossed at the ankle as if his last energy had been spent trying to keep warm by pressing his body tighter and tighter, his hands tucked under his arms while he hugged himself in what must have been an end in violent shivers. His blue eyes were open and frozen. His flesh was also blue and as hard to the touch as Carrara marble.
He must have swum to the floe, managed to climb up and froze to death here, softly suggested Mr. DeVoe. The thing from the ice didn't catch or maul Harry.
Captain Crozier only nodded. I knew that the captain had liked and much depended upon Harry Pegler. I also liked the foretop captain. Most of the men did. Then I saw what Crozier was looking at. All around the ice floe in the recent snow, especially around the corpse of Harry Pegler, were huge footprints, rather like a white bear's, with claws visibly indicated, only easily 3 or 4 times larger than any white bear's paw prints. The thing had circled Harry many times, watching as poor Mr. Pegler lay shivering and dying, enjoying itself, had Harry Pegler's last shivering image on this earth been of that white monstrosity looming over him, its black and blinking eyes watching? Why had the thing not eaten our friend? The beast was on two legs the entire time it was on the floe, was all that Captain Crozier said. Other men from the boats came forward with a piece of canvas. There was no exit from the lake in the ice, except for the rapidly closing lead from which we had come. Two circumnavigations of the body of open water, five boats rowing clockwise, four boats rowing anti-Wiggins, offered the discovery of only inlets, ruptures in the ice, and two more bloody swaths, where it looked as if one of our reconnaissance whaleboat's crew pulled himself onto the ice and ran, but was cruelly intercepted and pulled back. There were, thank God, shards of blue wool, but no more remains to be found. It was early afternoon by then, and to a man I am sure that we had but one wish, to be away from that accursed place. But we had three bodies of our shipmates, all parts of same, and we felt the need to dispose of them in an honourable way. Many of us assumed, I believe, and rightly so as it turned out, that these would be the last formal burial services the reduced remnants of our expedition would have the luxury to perform. No useful detritus was found floating in the ice lake, save for an expanse of soaked canvas from one of the Holland tents that had been aboard Lieutenant Little's doomed whaleboat. This was used to inter the body of our friend Harry Pegler. The partial skeletal remains I had investigated near the lead opening were left in the canvas shot bag. Mr. Reed's torso was sewn into an extra blanket sleeping bag. It is custom at burial at sea for one or more pieces of round shot to be placed at the foot of the man being committed to the deep, ensuring that the body will sink with dignity rather than float embarrassingly. But of course we had no round shot this day. The seamen scrounged a grapple from the floating bow of the Lady J. Franklin and some metal from the last of the empty Goldner food tins to weigh down the various shrouds. It took some time to pull the nine remaining boats from the black water and reset the cutters and pinnaces onto sledges. The assembly of these sledges and the lifting of the boats onto them, with its concomitant packing and unpacking of stores, drained the skeletal crewmen of the last of their energy. Then the seamen gathered near the edge of the ice, standing in a broad crescent so as not to put too much weight on any one part of the ice shelf. No one was in the mood for a long service, and certainly not for the previously appreciated irony of Captain Crozier's fabled Book of Leviathan, so it was with some surprise, and not a small bit of emotion, that we listened to the captain recite from memory Psalm 90.
Lord, thou hast been our refuge from one generation to another, before the mountains were brought forth, or ever the earth and the world were made. Thou art God from everlasting, and world without end. Thou turnest man to destruction. Again thou sayest, come again, ye children of men. For 1,000 years in thy sight are but as yesterday, seeing that is past as a watch in the night. As soon as thou scatterest them, they are even as asleep, and fade away suddenly like the grass. In the morning it is green and groweth up, but in the evening it is cut down, dried up, and withered. For we consume away in thy displeasure, and are afraid at thy wrathful indignation. Thou hast set our misdeeds before thee, and our secret sins in the light of thy countenance. For when thou art angry, all our days are gone. We bring our years to an end, as if it were a tale that is told. The days of our age are 70 years, and though men be strong, that they come to 80 years, yet is their strength then but labour and sorrow. So soon passeth it away, and we are gone. But who regardeth the power of thy wrath? For even thereafter, as a man feareth, so is thy displeasure. So teach us to number our days, that we may apply our hearts unto wisdom. Turn thee again, O Lord, at the last, and be gracious unto thy servants. Oh, satisfy us with thy mercy, and that soon. So shall we rejoice and be glad all the days of our life. Comfort us again now, after the time that thou hast plagued us, and for the years wherein we have suffered adversity. Show thy servants thy work, and their children thy glory. And the glorious majesty of the Lord our God be upon us. Prosper thou the work of our hands upon us. O prosper thou our handiwork. Glory be to the Father, and to the Son, and to the Holy Ghost, as it was in the beginning, is now, and ever shall be, world without end. Amen.
And all of us shivering survivors spake, Amen. There was a silence then. The snow blew softly against us. The black water lapped with a hungry sound. The ice groaned and shifted slightly beneath our feet. All of us, I believe, were thinking that these words were a eulogy and farewell for each one of us. Up until this day, and the loss of Lieutenant Little's boat with all his men, including the irreplaceable Mr. Reed and the universally liked Mr. Pegler, I suspect that many of us still thought that we might live. Now we knew that the odds of that had all but disappeared. The long-awaited and universally cheered open water was a vicious trap. The ice will not give us up, and the creature from the ice will not allow us to leave. Bosun Johnson called, Ship's company, off hats! We tugged off our motley and filthy head coverings.
Know that our Redeemer liveth,
said Captain Crozier in that husky rasp that now passed for his voice,
and that he shall stand at the latter day upon the earth. And though, after our sin, worms destroy our bodies, yet in our flesh shall we see God, whom we shall see for ourselves, and our eyes shall behold, and not another. O Lord, accept your humble servants here, Ice Master James Reed, Captain of the Foretop, Harry Pegler, and their unknown crewmate, into your kingdom, and with the two we can name, please accept the souls of Lieutenant Edward Little, Seaman Alexander Berry, Seaman Henry Sate, Seaman William Wensall, Seaman Samuel Crisp, Seaman John Bates, and Seaman David Sims. When our day comes to join them, Lord, please allow us to join them in thy kingdom. Hear our prayer, O Lord, for our shipmates and ourselves, and for all our souls, and with thine ears consider our calling. Hold not thy peace at our tears. Spare us a little, that we may recover our strength, before we also go hence, and be no more. Amen.
Amen, we all whispered. The bosuns lifted the canvas burial shrouds and dropped them into the black water, where they sank within seconds. White bubbles rose like final efforts to speak from our departed shipmates. Then the surface of the lake grew black and still again. Sergeant Tozer and two marines fired a single volley from their muskets. I saw Captain Crozier stare at the black lake with an expression rich with suppressed emotions. We will go now, he said firmly to us, to all of us, to this slumped and sad and mentally defeated party. We can haul those sledges and boats a mile before it is time to sleep. We will head southeast toward the mouth of Back's River. The going will be easier out here on the ice. As it turned out, the going was much harder on the ice. In the end, it was impossible, not because of the usual pressure ridges and anticipated difficulty transporting the boats, although that was increasingly problematic because of our hunger, illness, and weakness, but because of the breaking ice and the thing in the water. Moving in relays as usual, but with nine fewer men on our expedition muster that long Arctic evening of 10 July, we progressed much less than a mile before stopping to pitch tents on the ice and to sleep at last. That sleep was interrupted less than 2 hours later when the ice suddenly began to crack and shift. The entire mass bobbed up and down. It was a most disquieting experience, and we all scrambled to the exits of our respective tents and milled in some confusion. Seamen began to strike the tents and make ready to pack the boats until Captain Crozier, Mr. Couch, and First Mate Devoe shouted them into stillness. The officers pointed out that there were no signs of cracks in the ice near us, only this movement. After 15 minutes or so of this, the ice quieted until the surface of the frozen sea under us once again felt as firm as stone. We crawled back into our tents. An hour later, the bobbing and cracking began again. Many of us repeated our earlier rush out into the blowing wind and dark, but the braver seamen stayed in their sleeping bags. Those of us who had taken fright crawled back into the ill-smelling and crowded little tents, filled as they were with snores, sleeping exhalations, overlapping bodies in wet bags, and the ripeness of men who had not changed their clothes in several months, with abashed countenances. Fortunately, it was too dark for anyone to notice. All that next day, we struggled to haul the boats forward to the southeast, across a surface no more solid than a tightly drawn skin of India rubber. Cracks were appearing, some showing 6 feet thickness of ice, and more between the surface and the sea, but our sense of crossing a plain of ice had disappeared, replaced with the reality of moving from floe to floe on an undulating ocean of white. I should record here that on that second evening after we left the enclosed ice lake, I was catching up with my duty of going through the dead men's personal belongings, most of which had been left behind in our general stores when Lieutenant Little's reconnaissance group left in their whaleboat, and had come to Captain of the Foretop Pegler's small pack, containing a few scraps of clothes, some letters, a few personal items such as a horn comb, and several books, when my assistant John Bridgens said, "Might I have a few of those things, Dr. Goodsir?" I was surprised. Bridgens was indicating the comb in a thick leather notebook. I had looked into the notebook already. Pegler had written in a crude sort of code, spelling words in reverse, capitalizing the last letter of the last word in each sentence, as if it were the first. But while the summary of the last year of our expedition might have held some interest for a relative, both the foretop captain's handwriting and sentence structure, not to mention his spelling, had grown more laboured and crude in the months immediately before and after our abandoning of the ships, until it had all but disintegrated. One entry read, "O death, where is thy sting? The grave at Comfort Cove, for who has any doubt how?" An illegible line here where the book has been damaged by water. "The dire sad." On the back side of that sheet, I had noticed where Pegler had drawn a shaky circle, and in that circle had written, "The Terror Camp Clear." The date had been illegible, but it must have been around 25 April. Another page nearby included such fragments as, "As we have got some very hard ground to heave, we shall want some grog to wet hower, issel. All my art, Tom, for I do think. Time, I close should lay, and the 21st night agreed." I had assumed upon seeing this that Pegler had recorded that entry on the evening of 21 April, when Captain Crozier had told the assembled crews of Terra and Erebus that the last of them would be abandoning ship the next morning. These were, in other words, the scribblings of a semi-literate man, and no proud reflection on the learning or skill of Harry Pegler. "Why do you want these?" I asked Bridgens. "Was Pegler a friend of yours?" "Aye, Doctor." "You require a comb?" The old steward was almost bald.
"No, Doctor, just a remembrance of the man. That and his journal will serve."
Very strange, I thought, since everyone was lightening their loads at this point, not adding heavy books to what they had to haul. But I gave Bridgens the comb and journal. No one needed Pegler's remaining shirt or socks or extra wool trousers or Bible, so I left them on the pile of discarded items the next morning. All in all, the abandoned final possessions of Pegler, Little, Reed, Berry, Crisp, Bates, Sims, Wensall and Sate made for a sad little cairn of mortality. That next morning, 12 July, we started coming across more bloody patches in the ice. At first, the men were terrified that these were more signs of our mates, but Captain Crozier led us to the great stained areas and showed us that in the centre of the great starburst of crimson was the carcass of a white bear. They were all murdered polar white bears. These blood-stained areas, often with little more than a shattered head, great bloodied white pelt, cracked bones and paws left behind. At first, the men were reassured. Then, of course, the obvious question set in. What was killing these huge predators just hours before our arrival? The answer was obvious.
But why was it slaughtering the white bears?
That answer was also obvious. To deprive us of any possible food source.
By 16 July, the men seemed incapable of going farther. In an 18-hour day of incessant pulling, we would cover less than a mile across the ice. Often we could see the previous night's pile of discarded clothing and gear when we camped the next evening. We had found more slaughtered white bears. Morale was so low that if we had taken a vote that week, the majority might have voted to give up, lie down, and die. That night of 16 July, as others slept, and only one man stood watch, Captain Crozier asked me to come to his tent. He now slept in the same tent with Charles Devoe, his purser Charles Hamilton Osmer, who was showing signs of pneumonia, William Bell, Erebus's quartermaster, and Philip Reddington, Sir John's and Captain Fitzjames's former captain of the forecastle. The captain nodded, and everyone except First Mate Devoe and Mr. Osmer left the tent to give us privacy. "Dr. Goodsir," began the captain, "I need your advice." I nodded and listened. "We have adequate clothing and shelter," said Captain Crozier. "The extra boots I had the men haul along in the supply pinnaces have saved many feet from amputation."
"I agree, sir," I said, although I knew this was not the item upon which he was asking for advice.
"Tomorrow morning, I am going to tell the men that we shall be leaving one of the whaleboats and two cutters and one pinnace behind, and will be continuing on only with the five remaining boats," said Captain Crozier. "Those two whaleboats, two cutters, and final pinnace are in the best condition and should suffice for open water, should we encounter any before the mouth of Back's River, since our stores are so reduced."
"The men will be heartily glad to hear this, Captain," I said.
I certainly was. Since I now helped man-haul the boats, the knowledge that the days of accursed relaying were over quite literally took some of the ache from my shoulders and back. "What I need to know, Dr. Goodsir," continued the captain, his voice an exhausted rasp, his face solemn, "is whether I can cut back on the men's rations, or rather, when we do cut back, will the men still be capable of hauling the sledges? I need your professional opinion, Doctor."
I looked at the floor of the tent. One of Mr. Diggle's hoosh pans, or perhaps Mr. Wall's portable contraption for heating tea, back when we had bottles of ether left for the spirit stoves, had burned a round hole there.
"Captain, Mr. Devoe," I said finally, knowing that I would be stating the obvious to them, "the men do not have enough nourishment now to meet the requirements of their daily labours." I took a breath. "Everything they eat is cold. The last of the canned foods was consumed many weeks ago. The spirit stoves and spirit lamps was left on the ice with the last empty bottle of pyroligneous ether. This evening at supper, each man will get one ship's biscuit, a sliver of cold salt pork, 1 ounce of chocolate, a palm full of tea, less than a spoonful of sugar, and his daily tablespoon of rum.
And his bit of tobacco that we'd hoarded for them," added Mr. Rosmer.
I nodded. "Yes, and his bit of tobacco. And they do love their tobacco." That was a brilliant stroke to keep some hidden in the stores. "But no, Captain, I cannot say that the men can get by on less than the current inadequate amount of food."
"They must," said Captain Crozier. "We shall be out of the salt pork in 6 days, out of the rum in 10.
Mr. Devoe cleared his throat.
"Everything depends upon us finding and shooting more seals on the floes."
So far I knew, everyone in the tent knew, everyone on the expedition knew, we had shot and enjoyed precisely 2 seals since leaving Comfort Cove 2 months earlier.
"I am thinking," said Captain Crozier, "that heading north again for the shore of King William Land, perhaps 3 days' pull, perhaps 4, might be best. It is possible to eat moss and rock tripe. I am told that the proper varieties cook up into an almost palatable soup. If one can find the proper varieties of moss and rock tripe."
"Sir John Franklin," I thought in my weariness, "the man who ate his shoes. My older brother had told me that story in the months before our departure. Sir John would have known, from pathetic experience, precisely which moss and rock tripe to choose."
"The men will be happy to get off the ice, Captain,"
was all that I could say, and they will be overjoyed to hear that we shall be hauling fewer boats.
Thank you, Doctor, said Captain Crozier. That is all.
I bobbed my head in a pathetic sort of salute, left, made the rounds of the worst scurvy victims in their tents. We no longer have a sick bay tent, of course, and Bridgins and I nightly go from tent to tent to counsel and dose our patients. And then I staggered back to my own tent, shared with Bridgins, the unconscious Davy Lays, the dying engineer Thompson, and the seriously ill carpenter Mr. Honey, and fell instantly asleep. That was the night that the ice opened and swallowed up the Holland tent, in which slept our five Marines, Sergeant Tozer, Corporal Hedges, Private Wilkes, Private Hammond, and Private Daly. Only Wilkes got out of the tent before it sank into the wine-dark sea, and he was pulled from the ice crevice seconds before it closed with a deafening crash. But Wilkes was too chilled, too ill, and too terrified to recover, even when Bridgins and I wrapped him in the last dry clothes in our reserve and put him between us in our sleeping bag. He died just before real sunrise. His body was left behind on the ice the next morning, along with more clothes, and the four discarded boats and their sledges. There was no burial service for him or the other Marines. There was no hurrah when the captain announced that the four sledges and boats would no longer be hauled. We turned north toward land just over the horizon. No retreat from Moscow ever felt such a sense of defeat. 3 hours later, the ice cracked again, and we were faced with leads and lakes to the north, which were too small to justify launching the boats, yet too large to allow us to haul the boats and sledges across.
Chapter 49. Crozier. King William Land, latitude unknown, longitude unknown. 26 July, 1848. When Crozier slept, even for a few minutes, the dreams returned. The two skeletons in the open boat, the intolerable American girls snapping toe joints to simulate a spirit rapping at a table in a darkened room, the American doctor posturing as a polar explorer, a pudgy man dressed in an Eskimo parka and wearing heavy makeup on an overbright gaslit stage. Then the two skeletons in an open boat again. The night always ending with the dream that disturbed Crozier the most. He is a boy, and he is with his Memo Moira in a vast Catholic cathedral. Francis is naked. Memo pushes him toward the altar rail, but he is afraid to go forward. The cathedral is cold. The marble floor under young Francis's bare feet is cold. There is ice on the white wooden pews. Kneeling at the altar rail, young Francis Crozier can feel Memo Moira watching approvingly from somewhere behind him, but he is too frightened to turn his head. Something is coming. The priest seems to rise up from some trapdoor set into the marble floor on the opposite side of the altar railing. The man is too large, far too large, and his vestments are white and dripping water, smelling of blood and sweat and something ranker. He towers over little Francis Crozier. Francis closes his eyes, and as Memo taught him while he knelt on the thin rug of her parlour, extends his tongue to receive the Eucharist. As important as this sacrament is, as necessary as he knows it must be, Francis is terrified to receive the host. He knows that his life will never be the same after receiving the papist Eucharist, and he also knows that his life will end if he does not receive it. The priest looms closer and leans toward him. Crozier awoke in the belly of the whaleboat. As always, when he came up out of these dreams, even if he had caught only a few minutes' sleep, his heart was pounding and his mouth was dry from fear, and he was shaking hard, but from cold more than from fear or the memory of fear. The ice had broken up in the part of the strait or gulf they were in on the 17th and 18th of July, and for 4 days after that, Crozier had kept the men together on the large ice floe where they had stopped, the cutters and pinnace removed from their sledges, all five of the boats fully loaded except for their tents and sleeping bags, and rigged for open water.
Each night, the rocking of their large floe and the cracking and fracturing of ice sent them scurrying from their tents, half awake, sure that the sea was opening up beneath them and ready to swallow them as it had Sergeant Tozer and his men. Each night, the gunshot explosions of the ice cracking eventually abated. The wild rocking fell into a more regular rhythm of swells, and they crawled back into their tents. It was warmer, some days rising almost to the freezing point. These few weeks of late July would almost certainly be the only hint of summer this second frozen-in Arctic year would see. But the men were colder and more miserable than ever. Some days it actually rained. When it was too cold to rain, ice crystals in the foggy air soaked their wool clothing, since it was too warm now to wear waterproof winter slops over their peacoats and greatcoats. Sweat from their man-hauling soaked their filthy underwear, filthy shirts and socks, and their ragged, ice-crusted trousers. Despite their almost depleted stores, the five remaining boats were heavier than the 10 boats they'd hauled before ever had been. For in addition to the eating, breathing, but still comatosely staring David Lays, more sick men had to be hauled along every day. Dr. Goodsir reported to Crozier each day that more feet, always soaked and in wet socks, in spite of all the extra boots Crozier had thought to bring along, turned rotten, more toes and heels turned black, and more feet had grown gangrenous and were now in need of amputation. The Holland tents were soaked and never dried. The sleeping bags they cracked open in the late evening and crawled into as darkness fell were soaked and frozen inside and out and never dried. When the men awoke in the morning after a few stolen minutes of fitful sleep, no amount of shivering could make one warmer. The inside of the circular and pyramid tents were lined with 30 pounds of hoarfrost that fell and dripped on the men's heads, shoulders, and faces as they tried to drink the tiny bit of lukewarm tea that was brought around to the tents each morning by Captain Crozier, Mr. DeVoe, and Mr. Couch. A strange reversal of commanders as morning stewards that Crozier had instigated during their first week on the ice, and which the men now took for granted. Mr. Wall, Erebus's cook, was sick with something like consumption and lay curled into the bottom of one of the cutters most of the time, but Mr. Diggle remained the same energetic, obscene, efficient, bellowing, and somehow reassuring figure he had been for 3 years at his post near the huge Fraser's patent stove aboard HMS Terror. Now, with the ether fuel depleted and the spirit stoves and heavy whaleboat coal stoves abandoned, Mr. Diggle's job was to portion out twice a day the small bit of cold salt pork and other victuals remaining, always under Mr. Osmer's and another officer's watchful supervision. But always the optimist, Diggle had cobbled together a crude seal oil stove and cooking pot, which he was ready to light if and when they shot more seals. Every day, Crozier sent out hunting parties to find those seals for Mr. Diggle's pot, but there were almost none to be seen, and those few sighted slipped back into their open leads or tiny holes before the hunters succeeded in shooting them. Several times, so the men on the hunting parties reported, the slippery black ring seals had been hit by buckshot, or even a musket ball or rifle bullet, but managed to slide back into the black water and dive out of reach before they died, leaving only a trail of blood on the ice. Sometimes the hunters knelt on the ice to lap at the blood. Crozier had been in summer Arctic waters many times before, and knew that by mid-July the water and opening floes should be teeming with life. Huge walruses sunning themselves on ice floes and flopping ponderously along the water's edge, their barks more a series of belches than barks. A proliferation of seals catapulting in and out of the water, like children playing and bellying their way comically across the ice. Beluga whales and narwhals, spouting and rolling and submerging in the open leads, filling the air with their fishy breaths. Female white bears swimming in the black water with their ungainly cubs and stalking seals on floes, shaking the water out of their strange fur as they pulled themselves from the ocean to the ice, avoiding the larger and more dangerous males, which would eat the cubs and the sow as well if their bellies were empty. Finally, seabirds flying overhead in such profusion as to almost darken the blue Arctic summer sky. Birds on shore, on floes and lining the irregular tops of icebergs, like musical notes on a score, while more terns and gulls and gerfalcons skimmed the water everywhere. This summer, for the second year in a row, almost nothing living moved across the ice. Only Crozier's diminished and diminishing men, gasping in their man-hauling halters, and their relentless pursuer, always briefly and partially glimpsed, always out of rifle or shotgun range. A few times in the evening, the men heard the yip of Arctic foxes and frequently found their dainty tracks in the snow, but none ever seemed to make itself visible to the hunters. When the men did see or hear whales, they were always many floes and small leads over, too far to reach, even by frenzied, careless running, men throwing themselves from rocking floe to rocking floe before the sea mammals casually breached and dove and disappeared again. Crozier had no idea if they could kill a narwhal or beluga with the few small arms they carried, but he thought they could. A few rifle bullets to the brain should kill anything short of the beast that stalked them, which the seamen had long decided was no beast at all, but a wrathful god out of the captain's book of Leviathan. And if they somehow had the strength to drag a whale onto the ice and render it down, the oil would power Mr. Diggle's stove for weeks or months, and they would eat blubber and fresh meat until they all burst. What Crozier most wanted to do was to kill the thing itself. Unlike the majority of his men, he believed it was mortal, an animal, nothing more. Smarter, perhaps, than even the frighteningly intelligent white bear, but still a beast. If he could kill the thing, Crozier knew, the mere fact of its death, the pleasure of revenge for so many deaths, even if the rest of the expedition still were to die later from starvation and scurvy, would temporarily lift the morale of the survivors more than discovering 20 gallons of untapped rum. The beast had not bothered them, not killed any of them, since the ice-enclosed lake where Lieutenant Little and his men had died. Each of the hunting parties the captain sent out had standing orders to return immediately should they find the thing's tracks in the snow. Crozier intended to take every man who could walk and every weapon that could fire out to stalk the beast. If he had to, he would use men banging pots and pans and shouting to flush the thing out, as if it were a tiger in the high grass of India being brought to bay by beaters. But Crozier knew this would work no better than the late Sir John's bear blind. What they really needed to bring the thing closer was bait. Crozier had no doubt whatsoever that it was still keeping pace with them, moving in closer during the increasing hours of darkness, hiding wherever it hid, perhaps under the ice, during the day, and that it would come even closer if they could bait it in. But they had no fresh meat, and if they had even a pound of fresh kill, the men would devour it, not use it as bait to catch the thing. Still, Crozier thought, while remembering the impossible great size and mass of the monstrous thing on the ice, there was more than a ton of meat and muscle there, perhaps several tons, since the larger male white bears weighed up to 1,500 pounds, and the thing made its white bear cousins look like hunting dogs next to a large man in comparison. So, they would eat well for many weeks if they did manage to murder their murderer. And with every bite, Crozier knew, even eating the thing flesh as they were the salt pork while on the march, there would be the pleasure of revenge, even if it had to be a dish best served cold. If it would work, Francis Crozier knew he would set himself out onto the ice as bait. If it would work. If it would save and feed even a few of his men, Crozier would offer himself to the beast as bait and hope that his men, who had proved themselves atrocious shots even before the last of Terra's marines died in the cold water, would be able to shoot the monster often enough, if not accurately enough, to bring it down, whether the Crozier bait survived or not. With the thought of the marines came, unbidden, the memory of Private Henry Wilkes's body, left behind in one of the abandoned boats a week earlier. There had been no gathering of the men for Wilkes's non-burial, only Crozier, Devoe, and a few of the marines' closer friends saying a few words over the body before dawn. "We should have used Wilkes's body for bait," thought Crozier, as he lay in the bottom of the rocking whaleboat, while the other men slept in heaped piles around him. Then he realized, and not for the first time, that they had fresher bait with them. David Lay's had been nothing but a burden for 8 months,
ever since the night in December of last year, when the thing had given chase to the late Ice Master Blanky. Lays staring at nothing since that night, unresponsive, useless, hauled in the boat like 130 pounds of soiled laundry for almost 4 months now, nonetheless managed to slurp down his salt pork broth and rum ration every afternoon, and to swallow his spoonful of tea and sugar each morning. It was to the men's credit that none of them, not even the whispering Hickey or Aylmore, had suggested leaving Lays behind, or any of the other sick men who currently could not walk. But everyone must have had the same thought. Eat them. Eat Lays first, then the others when they die. Francis Crozier was so hungry that he could imagine eating human flesh. He would not kill a man in order to devour him, not yet. But once dead, why should all that meat be left behind to rot in the Arctic summer sun? Or worse yet, left behind to be eaten by the thing that was after them. As a new lieutenant in his 20s, Crozier had heard, as all sailing men now heard sooner or later, usually as ship's boys before the mast, the true story of Captain Pollard in the U.S. brig Essex back in 1820. Essex had been stove in and sunk, so the few survivors later reported, by an 85-foot sperm whale. The brig went down in one of the emptiest parts of the Pacific, and the entire 20-man crew had been out of their boats hunting whales at the time, and returned to find their ship sinking fast. Retrieving a few tools, some navigation instruments, and one pistol from the ship, the survivors set off in 3 whaleboats. Their only provisions were 2 live turtles they'd captured in the Galapagos, 2 casks of ship's biscuits, and 6 casks of fresh water. Then they steered the whaleboats for South America. First, of course, they killed and ate the large turtles, drinking the blood when the meat was gone. Then they managed to capture some hapless flying fish who leapt into the boat by accident. While the men had contrived to cook the turtle meat, after a fashion, the fish they ate raw. Then they dived into the sea, scraped the barnacles from the hulls of their 3 open boats and ate those. Miraculously, the boats encountered Henderson Island, one of those few specks on the endless blue that is the Pacific Ocean. For 4 days, the 20 men captured crabs and stalked gulls and their eggs. But Captain Pollard knew that there were not enough crabs, gulls, or gull eggs on the island to sustain 20 men for more than another few weeks. So 17 of the 20 voted to take to the boats again. They launched the boats and waved goodbye to their 3 remaining companions on 27 December 1820. By 28 January, the 3 boats had been separated from one another by storm, and Captain Pollard's whaleboat sailed eastward alone under the endless sky. Their rations now consisted of 1.5 ounces of ship's biscuit per man a day for the 5 men in the whaleboat. By not so great a coincidence, this was precisely the reduced ration that Crozier had just secretly discussed with Dr. Goodsir and First Mate DeVoe for when the last of the salt pork ran out in a few days. The bit of biscuit and a few sips of water had kept Pollard's men, his nephew Owen Coffin, a freed black man named Barzillai Ray, and 2 seamen alive for 9 weeks. They were still more than 1,600 miles from land when the last of the biscuits ran out at the same time as the last of the water was drunk. Crozier had figured that if the biscuits lasted his men another month, they would still be more than 800 miles from human habitation in winter, even if they reached the mouth of Back's River. Pollard had no conveniently recently deceased men aboard his boat, so they drew straws. Pollard's young nephew, Owen Coffin, drew the short straw. Then they drew straws again to see who would do the deed. Charles Ramsdell drew the short straw this time. The boy wished the other men a tremulous goodbye. Crozier always remembered his scrotum-tightening sense of horror the first time he heard this part of the story, while on watch with an older man high in the mizzen of a warship far off Argentina. The old seaman terrifying Lieutenant Crozier by saying goodbye in a trembling boy's voice. And then young Coffin had laid his head on the gunwale and closed his eyes. Captain Pollard, as he later testified in his own words, had given Ramsdell his pistol and turned his face away. Ramsdell shot the boy in the back of the head. The 5 others,
including Captain Pollard, the boy's uncle, first drank the blood while it was warm. Although salty, it was, unlike the endless sea around them, drinkable. Then they sliced the boy's flesh from his bones and ate it raw. Then they broke open Owen Coffin's bones and sucked out the marrow to the last shred. The cabin boy's corpse had sustained them for 13 days, and just when they were considering drawing lots again, the black man, Barzillai Ray, died of thirst and exhaustion. Again, the draining, drinking, slicing, cracking, and sucking of marrow sustained them until they were rescued by the whaler Dauphin on 23 February, 1821.
Francis Crozier never met Captain Pollard, but he had followed his career. The unlucky American had retained his rank and gone to sea only once more, and once more was shipwrecked. After being rescued the second time, he was never again entrusted with command of a ship. The last Crozier heard, only a few months before Sir John's expedition sailed 3 years earlier in 1845, Captain Pollard was living as a town watchman in Nantucket, and was universally shunned by both townspeople and whalers there. It was said that Pollard had aged prematurely, spoke aloud to himself and his long-dead nephew, and hid biscuits and salt pork in the rafters of his home. Crozier knew that his people would have to make a decision about eating their own dead within the next few weeks, if not the next few days. The men were approaching the point where they were too few, and those few too weak to manhaul boats. But the four-day rest on the ice floe from the 18th to the 22nd of July had not renewed their energy. Crozier, Devoe, and Couch, young Lieutenant Hodgson, while technically the second in command, was given no authority by the captain these days, rousted men and ordered them out hunting or repairing sledge runners or caulking and re-repairing the boats, rather than let them lie in their frozen sleeping bags in their dripping tents all day. But essentially all they could do was sit on their connected floes for days, since too many tiny leads, fissures, small areas of open water, and patches of thin and rotten ice surrounded them to allow any progress south or east or north. Crozier refused to turn back west and northwest. But the floes were not drifting in the direction they wanted to go, southeast toward the mouth of Back's Great Fish River. They merely milled and circled upon themselves as the pack holding Erebus and Terror had for two long winters. Finally, on the afternoon of Saturday, 22 July, their own floe began cracking up enough that Crozier ordered everyone into the boats. For 6 days now they had floated, tethered together by lines in patches and leads too short or small to row or sail in. Crozier had the one sextant left to them. He had left the heavier theodolite behind, and while others slept, he took the best readings he could during the occasional short break in cloud cover. He reckoned their position to be about 85 miles northwest of the mouth of Back's River. Expecting to see a narrow isthmus ahead of them any day now, the presumed peninsula connected the bulb of King William Land to the previously mapped Adelaide Peninsula. Crozier had awakened in the boat at sunrise on the morning of Wednesday the 26th of July to find the air colder, the sky blue and cloudless, and glimpses of land darkening the sky more than 15 miles away to both the north and south. Calling the five boats together later, Crozier stood in the bow of his lead whaleboat and shouted,
"Men, King William Land is King William Island. I'm certain now that there's sea ahead all the way east and south to Back's River, but I'll bet my last quid that there's no land connecting the cape you see far to the southwest there and the one you see far to the northeast. We're in a strait, and since we have to be north of the Adelaide Peninsula, we've completed the goal of the Sir John Franklin expedition. This is the Northwest Passage. By God, you've done it!"
There was a weak cheer, followed by some coughing. If the boats and floes had been drifting south, weeks of manhauling or sailing work might have been done for them. But the leads and areas of open water in which they floated continued to crack open only toward the north. Life in the boats was as miserable as life on the floes in the tents had been. The men were crowded too close together. Even with boards on thwarts offering a second level for sleeping on those whaleboats and cutters with their sides built up by Mr. Honey, the disassembled sledges also served as a crossed T-deck amid ships on the crowded cutters and pinnace, Wet-wooled bodies were pressed against wet-wooled bodies, both day and night. The men had to hang out over the gunwales to shit, an event that was becoming less and less necessary, even for the men with serious scurvy, as the food and water grew less. But while all the men had lost all vestiges of modesty, a sudden wave often soaked bare skin and lowered trousers, leading to curses, boils, and longer nights of shivering misery. On the morning of Friday, 28 July, 1848, the lookout on Crozier's boat, the smallest man on each boat was sent up the short raised mast with a spyglass, spied a maze of leads opening all the way to a point of land to the northwest, perhaps 3 miles away. The able-bodied men in the 5 boats pulled, and when necessary pulled between narrowing ice ledges, the healthiest men at the bow hacking away with pickaxes and fending off with pikes for 18 hours. They landed on a rocky shingle, in a darkness broken only by short periods of moonlight when the returning clouds parted a little after 11 o'clock that night. The men were far too exhausted to dismount the sledges and lift the cutters and pinnaces onto them. They were too tired to unpack their soaked Holland tents and sleeping bags. They fell onto the rough stones where they had ceased their dragging of heavy boats across the shore ice and rocks made slippery by high tide. They slept in clumps, kept alive only by their crewmates' failing body warmth. Crozier did not even assign a watch. If the thing wanted them tonight, it could have them. But before he slept, he spent an hour trying to get a good sighting with his sextant and to work it out with the navigation tables and maps he still carried with him. As best he could reckon, they had been on the ice for 25 days and manhauled and drifted and rowed a total of 46 miles to the east-southeast. They were back on King William Land, somewhere north of the bulk of the Adelaide Peninsula, and now even farther from the mouth of Back's River than they had been 2 days earlier, about 35 miles northwest of the inlet across the unnamed strait they'd been unable to cross. If they even crossed this strait, they would be more than 60 miles up the inlet from the mouth of the river, a total of more than 900 miles from Great Slave Lake and their salvation. Crozier carefully stowed his sextant in his wooden case and set the case away in its oilskin waterproof bag, found a sodden blanket from the whaleboat, and threw it down on stones next to Devoe and 3 sleeping men. He was asleep within seconds. He dreamt of Memo Moira shoving him forward toward an altar rail and of the waiting priest in dripping vestments. In his sleep, as the men snored in the moonlight of this unknown shore, Crozier closed his eyes and extended his tongue to receive the body of Christ.